I'm Anna Nguyen, and you're listening to Critical Literary Consumption, a podcast where I ask my guests, her authors, poets, and scholars, about their reading and writing practices. Some topics I explore are, what's the author responding to? What are the possible tensions between author, text, and audience? Whose interpretations matter? What could be a miscitation? And how language is used and constructed? My guest today is Erica N. Cardwell, a writer, critic, and educator based in Brooklyn and Toronto. She is the recipient of a 2021 Andy Warhol Foundation Arts Writers Grant. Her writing has appeared in Arts Black, Freeze, Bomb, The Believer, The Brooklyn Rail, Cultured, and other publications. She received her MFA in writing from Sarah Lawrence College and is currently an assistant professor in the Department of English at the University of Toronto Scarborough. All right, Erica, first of all, want to wish you a happy publication day on
Thank you. Beautiful memoir.
Yes, of course. So when reading Wrong Is Not My Name, there are a few threads in your collection of essays and notes. In the preface, in which you reference Adrienne Rich, you tell us your mother passed away because of a car accident, and you were then gifted her journals. And a constant question that you had that recurred in the essay collection, the memoir, is whether or not your mother was an artist. So we see this question haunt the pages, and then we kind of see you weave in these theories and personal stories about art, grief, and criticism. I was curious to know if this working question, whether your mother was an artist, was always the one that you want to explore in the book.
Thank you so much for that question. I love it. And thank you for interviewing me for your podcast. First of all, I love the use of the word haunted. There's another interview that I did recently that also uses that word. And I felt that was the experience I had writing the book as very much like a conduit. And I say that very openly and willingly. And I know that oftentimes concepts of being haunted and conduit and spirituality can be a bit hokey for people, but I really mean it genuinely. And so this rhetorical conceit, the question of was my mother an artist, was the original curiosity from day one of writing this book. It sort of arrived when I realized that I was exploring her, that I really wanted to think through her role in my life. And it centers around this tension between experiencing the grief of losing her and the mourning process and the sense of awakening that I had as a writer and as a person obsessed with art and culture. And so I found that tension to be curious and fascinating. And I really believed this book was an endeavor to disentangle that and learn more about who I was becoming. So it was really in an effort to think out loud about myself and to sort of imagine conversations with my mother. I used that question to kind of do a rhetorical examination of us, of her and I, of myself and art, of her with art, and art being visual culture, music, the books and plays I was reading. So yes, was my mother an artist was the original conceit for the book and remained. And when I first started writing, I was kind of calling this process an exploration of the Black imagination, because I found the interwoven texture of grief and awakening to be kind of a fundamental aspect of Black identity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I really love your thoughts about genre. You were thinking about what does it mean to do criticism, specifically art criticism and Black creativities. So I think I read two versions. I read the advanced reader copy Feminist Press sent to me, and then I read the one you had sent me, I think was more like the final version. Mm-hmm. And we see you analyzing these kind of canonical texts. And so you mentioned visual culture was it's a very strong element in your essays. Mm-hmm. And I really love your pedagogical interpretations of them and how you talked about technology and politics play into this idea of criticism. Mm-hmm. You yourself mentioned the kind of tired binary of politics and art. And that's something that we kind of see in this, I feel like we always see it in every kind of present political discourse, especially when something major is happening in the world. Where do you see art criticism in the future? And do you think we'll always have these kinds of discussions where there's no real certainty or answer?
Mm-hmm. This is such a great question. I have so many thoughts kind of spinning in a few different directions. I mean, I think the internet really offers us a certain kind of agency. It's not kind of a holistic agency, but it does give all of us the sense that we can curate our personas and our opinions, and that there are forums for us to express ourselves and feel heard, even if it's temporary. But I think what I find important that differentiates from what the internet does and what critical art writing can do could easily be described by old-fashioned reviews, like in newspapers, and you know, and you're deciding what movie you're gonna go see. All of this is of an era. Now we see movies in our living rooms, in our bedrooms, on our phones. But when I was growing up, you know, you decided what movie you were going to see, and you looked at the movie times in the newspaper, and then you looked at the review, like a little tiny review. I'm still really in love with that, and I'm still really in love with even reading reviews today that are in book form. Whenever I get book form, I get it in the mail and I like to open it up and read it, or just see all of this dialogue that's created through a work of art. That's what I'm hoping we can preserve about the future of art criticism, is some very traditional reviewing. That being said, I also want to engage with the body vis-a-vis art, and I'm hoping that will become more of a welcome sphere, because a lot of those old-fashioned reviews are, whether that's in an art historical canon or a literary canon, have a certain mode of operation and a way of existing and a certain people that need to write it. And I think that is meant to excise the body and excise the personal. And so I am interested in more people engaging with art through body and through embodiment, through spirituality, through more discursive forms. So that's another, I guess, hope for art writing. But I think all of these things are political, but I think that a real kind of political stance would really have to do with dismantling algorithms in terms of how we receive the kind of art that we love, instead of this like distillation and this pilfering between how to create taste, because now our tastes are being filtered to us. That makes me so frustrated, and I'm always trying to disrupt it. I'm always like purposely putting something in a search engine to kind of confuse the algorithm, even though I think that it's kind of impossible. But I do find that algorithms are a bit dangerous for the future of art and arts writing, because of the disruption of individually curated taste. We can't get lost as much anymore in arts writing. Yeah. And I think that's part of maybe what I was saying before about the kind of old-fashioned reviews, is like you can read and discover, and now there's so much more curated and kind of a wrap-up of what your searches have brought to you, or what the internet, the algorithm has designed based on your identity. in this little here.
I know in the essays, there were moments where the reader knows you finished your MFA program, and there were moments where you maybe were in the process of applying for a PhD program, was that right? Had you done your PhD program, would you have continued into this exploration of criticism and art, do you think?
Oh, I love this. Thank you for asking this. This is one of my secret dreams. Yes, I think so. I had wanted to study cultural anthropology. I was really interested in kind of a similar approach, you know, why we make art, what are the impulses that create culture, like really looking at sort of those origins. And I do think a PhD would have led me into a deeper exploration of life writing and biography and memoir writing and anti-memoir and auto-theory. So I think I would have probably, even studying a PhD, really craved writing classes and the praxis of writing. I think I would have spent a lot of time exploring the formation of culture. Yeah. Thank you for that. I love that.
Yes, of course. I wasn't sure if I was prying too much when I asked that question, but I remember vivid sections where you're kind of pouring through archives. And then you mentioned there were like applications, unfinished applications of your PhD program. It really struck me because you're kind of engulfed in paperwork and objects. And so that really stood out to me. You use this very interesting word, anti-memoir. Can you tell me more about anti-memoir?
Yes. Recently, I had a conversation about this with the writer Keo McClear, the author of Birds, Art, Life. I met her at a book event, and we were talking about auto theory and auto fiction. And she mentioned anti-memoir, and we've sort of been kind of corresponding informally about it. And I think we're both interested in the ways that the self can be refracted through the collective and through sort of an examination of the self through, I should say, the self beyond the individual. And I found that fascinating. It made me want to explore my writing very differently now. And particularly my next project, it made me want to think through a little bit more of the collective voice. I do think that anti-memoir could be attributed to elements of Wrong Is Not My Name, because it's not a traditional memoir in any sense, and I never wanted it to be. And so at times, there's so much that's personal that I've shared in it. But when people ask me, are you concerned with how personal you were in the book? I've opened up this whole portal of my life. I really view memoir writing, specifically auto theory and what a lot of Latinx scholars call theories of the flesh. When we're writing theories of the flesh, I really find the process to introduce the body as evidence and life as evidence. And so I don't feel that I've excavated or exploited too much of myself in the process. And I also find it to be just so necessary. So I think there is an anti-memoir element where it isn't sort of a linear exploration.
I love the genre that is, as you described, anti-memoir, because I feel like your book reads in many ways. Like there's art criticism, mm-hmm. there's personal writing, and also there's a very deep theoretical reflection on the text that you're in conversation with. And I especially think it was prevalent in the first essay, Chicken Soup, Seven Attempts. I love that essay so much because there was such a richness to the way you described food and the objects in the kitchen and just the environment that is in kitchen. And so when I read the earlier passages of that essay, it really reminded me of Barbara Smith's essay, A Press of Our Own, Kitchen Table, Woman of Color Press, in which she highlights that the kitchen is not the only center of the home where women work and communicate alongside each other, but the table itself represents a grassroots organization. Why did you want to begin your collection with that essay?
Thank you so much. So with Chicken Soup, I worked on it for many, many years. It really became this kind of stifling question of how to begin the book. And I had multiple origin stories, like we all do, but I felt a little stuck by where to start, because I had a lot of places that I felt were my origin story. New York City felt like a huge, crucial beginning for me. Moving to New York, being 18 in New York in the year 2000, like I felt that was such a meaningful time in our culture and in my life. And then I also felt like there were some specific elements from my childhood that represented the beginning. The one in particular that I wrote about in Chicken Soup was making the chicken soup and throwing it out and noticing that that was kind of the start of something inside of me, a certain disposition, I should say. And then I wanted to also introduce my mother and my mother and I in conversation. Mm-hmm. And in an early way to really set up our dynamic. And then I also found the use of Wandell Cummings as really central to, it kind of encapsulated everything I was trying to say, specifically her chicken soup performance as acknowledging an ancestral background, and that her performance piece was calling in all of these elements that I just described, you know, who we become, and then how the act of cooking can conjure our ancestors. And I felt she was the place I wanted to begin as a point of reference within the art historical canon. I really wanted to make my own effort of writing her into this canon and making her feel like an important element and an important place of origin. And that's when I realized that I was also writing about the kitchen table, and that the kitchen table is an origin story for so many of us cross-culturally. And it's where a lot of our identities are cultivated, and specifically where a lot of the Black imagination could be witnessed, this concept of grief and creativity, mm-hmm. this like inner entanglement. And so I said to myself, I didn't have to choose. And so I decided to begin with all of them. And that's why I made it 7 attempts. I kind of was inspired by the Janet Malcolm essay, 41 False Starts, where she explores her interactions with the artist David Sal. And I've always loved that essay. I love both the brilliance of entering a story 41 different times, but also the specific tedium too of even reading it and journeying through this with her, and then the acts of confession that show up throughout as well. And so that's what I was hoping to do with this, and that's a big reason why. And it was a bit of a lengthy process. It showed up for me in fits and starts. Yeah.
You said the book was many years of writing. How long was it? I felt like I read it was 8 years, but maybe that was a made up number. It was 8 years. Okay.
Yeah, 8 years. I started in 2015. And, you know, I think I just kind of was, I felt like a conduit at times, like it was kind of came to me in these different bursts. And so in between those bursts, it was difficult. You know, it was hard to know what I was writing. But it made for a lot of material that I ended up wading through and having to kind of separate because there were several different stories that I was telling. I do have a compulsive sense as a writer, and so I have to sometimes kind of slow the train down.
Erica, because we're on the topic of the kitchen and kitchen table, can you tell us more about your beautiful cover? What's the story behind the cover? Why did you want to choose it as a cover?
Absolutely, that would be my pleasure. So the cover is a painting by the artist Genesis Jerez, and I'm just looking at it now, and it's called Diluvio. And what I love about the cover is the impression of it being a bit unfinished, the aspect of there being like a spectral sense, like a spectral body, and I wanted to elevate the still life as well, and I didn't want to have a figure on the cover. I wanted sort of the idea of a figure, and I think it touches upon the haunting that we were speaking about earlier as well.
I think when I posted about your book, I just loved everything, including the cover. It was just a very, I don't think much about book covers. I'm not sure why, but I was really drawn to the image of your book cover, and then to
Thank
read
you.
it as a kind of as interlude or a preview to the first essay. It was just like it seemed like it was a very purposeful kind of way to read into the book from the cover, preface, and then the first essay.
Thank you. Yeah, I kind of knew I wanted it as the cover for a long time, and I kind of felt like that was a bit crazy too, so I just like kept a little document. It was like, I hope this could work out. And so Genesis was a studio museum artist in residence in 2020 into 2021, and I interviewed her, and we had a series of studio visits. And I also write about her in the Adabunmi essay. And so we have a really solid relationship, and I didn't think necessarily that she would say no. I was just was unsure if my publisher would be open to it, but the feminist press is kind of open to everything. They're really interested in a book that the writer has dreamed of, which is such a rare thing in publishing, and that's why I feel like it's important to say, like, they really want to make sure that the things that we vision, they want to make possible. So I'm really, really grateful.
And I want to spend some time talking about your book title. It's very captivating. Wrong is not my name. And then when I saw your subtitle, Notes on Black Art, I immediately thought of it being in conversation with Christina Sharpe's Ordinary Notes. Was that book an inspiration at all? And my other follow-up question is, why is the word black in parentheses? It's very visual. That's why I want to ask about it.
Yeah, so a couple of things. So the Wrong's Not My Name is a reference to Poem About My Rights by June Jordan, in which I have an essay that explores, I do a little bit of a close read of Poem About My Rights, and specifically hope to align myself with some of the exploration that June Jordan was doing with that poem and about elements of womanhood and Black womanhood. Also, Wrong Is Not My Name is a phrase that was extremely healing for me during a difficult time in my life. I often will tattoo phrases on my body once I get through something, and I have this tattoo of some phrases from Gloria Azal-Dua's Borderlands I can show you because you have tattoos that I was going to ask you about. You can't really see it, but it has some of the Latin from Borderlands in it. So whenever I find myself writing certain phrases, specifically from feminist scholars over and over again in my journal, I really feel the need to imprint them in my life somehow. And Wrong Is Not My Name is definitely something that helped me stay alive and helped me stay committed to myself as a writer and as a person. And so the parentheses, I like it, thinking of it as sort of like a whisper moment among Black folks where we can speak to each other. And it's sort of an acknowledgement of the ways in which the canon does not always make space for us and speak to us. And so the parentheses is for us. And I kind of touched upon it in the essay, Bathgia's Children.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about how Ralph Lemon uses the parentheses as well. It was intentional to sort of be talking specifically among Black people and Black artists.
Mm-hmm.
And then the notes part. So my title was chosen before her book came out, but I found the connections to be so incredible because she also writes closely about her mother. And I've been in contact with her and been able to express some of these parallels. But I do love the notes. I do love the notes because I've always wanted books to feel diaristic.
Mm-hmm.
I've wanted it to feel like almost like a notebook lingering in my bag that I've added ideas to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted it to be notes and not essays, so it could feel purposely discursive.
Mm-hmm.
And purposely like a almost like a log or a catalog.
Mm-hmm. Because I read the ARC that Feminist Press sent me, and when I was reading the file that you sent me, I didn't note any major changes unless I misread it. So I guess my question would be, in the 8 years that it took to write this,
mm-hmm.
how much of the original vision changed or didn't change? I know you said at least the origin story aspect, you weren't very committed in
mm-hmm.
a vision for that first story, but I'm curious to know how, because 8 years for a project is very, I just
it
imagine,
is
of course, there are major structural changes. So was there anything mm-hmm. that you left out that you may want to return for a different project?
Oh.
Or?
Yeah. Well, in terms of the kind of difference between the ARC you received and the published version, the published version has images. That's sort of the biggest difference. So yeah, it's missing. That's why I'll make sure you get a copy of this one. It has just about 8 images, so I can show you this is one of them.
Oh, is that what
yeah.
the boxes were in the ARC, maybe?
That's right, exactly.
Okay.
We didn't have the rights yet, and so we needed to get it out into the world. But yeah, there's some beautiful stuff. There's Sangha Ningudi's Swing Low, which I'm so honored to have.
But
I love this. I love thinking about what I took out. I think that I'd like to use later. I mean, I wrote a lot about living in New York, and some of that is in there, but not all of it, because it would have maybe made it spin out a bit more in a different direction. And then there's a lot more writing about my parents, but in the sense of, like, I have a whole chapter I wrote about my mother's house, and I had tried for a long time to create a more auto theory version of it. That was probably one of the more straight up memoir pieces, honestly,
mm-hmm.
that I took out. But I loved writing, and that kind of flowed out of me, but it just didn't fit in the grand scheme of the book. So maybe I'll publish that as like a single essay in the future, or put it out in another book. But yeah, I had to kind of lift out a few things to kind of make sure I was creating a clear
mm-hmm.
through line.
Yeah. I should have asked you this earlier. Your MFA, what was your concentration? Is it about art criticism or visual arts?
It was actually in creative nonfiction. So
Oh,
I don't
cool.
have an art history degree or an art criticism degree. Yeah, I really focused on writing, which was fun. It really felt kind of like I was getting to go to art school, like I was getting to do the kind of thing that a painter would do and kind of look really closely at something, look really closely at their craft for a solid period of time. Yeah, but sometimes back to what you said about PhD, yeah, I do sort of wish I had the chance to spend time studying artwork, works of art, maybe not from an art historical lens, but just a little more of a expansive study. But then writing this book was its own degree program. I feel like all the research that I did was like this could be a thesis in a lot of ways. Yeah.
I'm so embarrassed. I just glanced down at your biography and it says that you received your MFA in writing, but the way that you wrote about art, I just thought there was like you had such a visual aspect to it that I thought that your
Oh yeah,
MFA was
no.
in art.
No, that's thing. I'm grateful that you perceived that. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think it, like I said, I feel like this book is my own degree program.
Yeah,
It's
because I it really
about
was
that.
like a call for a way to consider art criticism, especially one that honors Black creativity. That so it's like its own kind of theoretical aspiration to it, I feel. That's so.
Yeah, thank you for that. I mean, I think I love when art critics formulate their theses through non-traditional pathways. And so I always think about how like Michael Musto, the Village Voice critic, writes about club culture and initially, I think got his job at the Village Voice because he'd been seen out writing for another publication. And so it's more of the like who's at the shows versus who is studying the work, you know, and then who's like obsessed with seeing the art or reading the books as opposed to like who has the degrees, which is like, you know, potentially a contentious opinion, but I kind of like think of it that way.
My last question for you, Erica, is I'm curious to know if you could share any upcoming or future writing projects that you have in mind.
Absolutely. So I have a couple of reviews coming out. I wrote a review on Faye Driscoll's recent performance called Weathering, the choreographer Faye Driscoll. So I have a review of that coming out for this magazine called Public Journal. And then I have an interview with the artist Jatavia Gary coming out in C Magazine for their Kink issue. And in terms of my next book project, I'm really interested in continuing this exploration of inheritance that I've kind of informally been doing through the lens of my parents and taking this theme and really looking at it through material and the ways that artists work with textiles and quilting and coding. And so I'm curious about like embedded inheritances and how like information is kind of passed that way. And it'll certainly be a bit of an auto-theoretical theories of the flesh kind of piece that really looks also at my own body and what inheritance looks like within the body. So yeah, I'm excited about it.
And I wonder if there's a way to go back to that piece you wrote about your mother's home. Maybe it could tie into like the material
Yes.
visual. Yeah. I
Yes,
would
thank
really
you
love to
for
read that. I'm sorry for interrupting. I'm really excited about your project, so.
that. Well, no, thank you so much. No, Thank you for reminding me of that piece because I haven't read it in a while. So you're making me think I should open it up and look at it.
Maybe you can even add photos because now, like, I'm so embarrassed. I feel like I always tell people I'm such a careful reader that I miss your entire, the pictures and like your actual version. It's such a, there's something about the way you write prose and then the visual aspects of it are very, it's just very well done. Sometimes I read things that they don't, there's a disconnect or something, but the way that I'm looking back at your writing and your images, they're very connected. Like it doesn't seem disjointed.
Thank you. That means a lot. And you are a very close reader. So,
why are you being
I'm going to make sure you get a hard copy version with the images.
Please.
Well.
And I hope we get to connect. I feel like we're so geographically close that I would love for you to like talk about visual to sign my copies or something.
Yeah, that'd be a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Erica, for taking the time to talk to me. And I hope we stay in touch and that you can come back on the podcast.
My pleasure. I would love to come back. Yes. Take good care. Okay. All right. Talk to you soon.
Bye. Bye. Thank you for listening. You can reach me on Twitter and Instagram at @AnnaDroid. I'd also like to thank Mariah Behrens for creating the cover art for my podcast and my partner, Matthew Sample, for his music and edits. See you next time.